go ahead and convene the regular and supplemental meetings or call to order, and we'll recess the supplemental meeting. First item of business is a moment of silence. On the diligent page 5, there's a list of those retirees, fire and police, who have passed in June and early July. So let's just take a moment of silence for them. Thank you. Next is the consent agenda, and the first item is approval of the minutes of the June 10th meeting. I was not there, so I'm not going to motion anything, but if somebody who was there, Armando, thank you.
Second,
Ken. Any discussion or comments or questions anybody has? Hearing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Nobody opposed, so that carries. That moves us on to the remainder of the consent agenda that starts on page 12 in Diligent. Kelly, anything unusual here?
Yes, good morning, everyone. We actually replaced the consent agenda that's in Diligent a couple of days ago. So if you reviewed it early on, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, you reviewed an old one. The change was we had a few deaths that came in after the agenda posting, and for specific reasons, we wanted to make sure that we could accelerate the payment for a couple of those survivors. So we went ahead and added some survivors to that, so as soon as we get their paperwork, we can pay them and not have to wait until the next. It accelerates the payment by about a month. So that's the only change.
Okay. The only other thing, too, on this, and this is what I was telling you on Monday, and I could be wrong, but I think Ernie Kaufman is fire, not police.
Ernie Kaufman is a firefighter.
Okay, thank you. We'll make that change. Appreciate that.
Okay, so pending receipt of documentation, the update on the approval of survivors, and item 5 are noted, and that will be subject to going forward with the approvals that are normally necessary. So we get a motion to approve.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Anybody opposed? No? Okay. Next is the open for public comment. John, can you give the instructions if anybody wants to make any comments?
Yeah, on the phone, so press 5-star. Have one, two.
Okay. Put them on, please.
Ending in 1111.
Yes, that's me.
Do you want to address the board, sir?
Yes, I'm sorry. I first time I've done this. My name is Larry Williams, retired firefighter. I have a question for Kelly, actually. I know today that we're going to discuss the possibility of lowering the discount rate from either 7% to either 6.75 or 5%. And I'm in agreement that we should always use a number that's realistic. However, I'm asking for a point of clarification concerning the effects on our funding ratio. In the hearings in Austin concerning change of survivor benefits, Kelly stated that our funding ratio was actually around 38%, or as I recall, that's what she said. The January 2020 number was at around 43%. So to make sure we're talking about apples and oranges here, I'd like to actually find out what our current funding ratio is. That's all I have to say, and thank you.
Thank you. Kelly, do you have that handy?
Yes. I mean, normally, Mr. Williams, we don't – it's public comment isn't a Q&A, but since this item is on the agenda, and I'll go ahead and address it in case you're not able to stay around. I don't know what the 38% number refers to. That might be a reference I've made to the lowest we dipped down to, but I – I don't know if that's the lowest, but that sounds like that. The most recent information we have is from the January 1, 2020 actuarial evaluation, so it's about a year and a half old, and as you know from being on the board in the past, we're delayed because some of our asset reporting. So the most recent actuarial evaluation is the one you referred to, and based on the actuarial evaluation of assets, the funding ratio is 45.73, and on market value is 43.66. Hopefully that answers your question.
Okay, Kelly. Okay, then we'll move on.
Please, we have another one.
Okay, go ahead.
Number ending in 7747.
Good morning. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Good morning. My name is, again, this is Bourbon Smith, Dallas Police Officer here at Northeast Division. Multiple things to talk about right quick. Again, still trying to get you guys and ladies to come meet with us in person. This has been going on since March. I'm not sure what's going on, why we can't get this done. I've had multiple excuses of from COVID to now that we're going to, you're looking into meeting with the board members to come up with a protocol to meet with us. I'm hoping you're not coming up with a protocol to silence the members here. Multiple lawsuits going on that we have no knowledge of, that we're nervous about, that you claim you can't share any information with us. We need to hear something. I've done open records requests to ask for that information, to share some part of it with us, at least an overall view. I don't think that's too much to ask for. We're continuously asking for our representative, Ken Haben, for the police department to resign. I can't even get this individual to email me back. You guys are having online meetings about detention or drop or whatever, and we had to hear about this third hand from going down to the fire department and hearing from those guys. And they're telling us, oh, you didn't know anything about it? What kind of communication is that to let us know? As much as we've been emailing and contacting you about information and coming out to meet with us, how can we have this man, Ken Haben, representing us, and he's not even an active member? He's a retiree. I've done an open records request to ask for all individuals, including Mr. Haben, to find out who has received their lump sum benefit and if he's received his. If he has, what is your purpose of being on this board? These rules need to be changed, or laws need to be changed, so that this never happens again. This should never happen again. And I know that a lot of you have a great conscience, and I know you agree with most of the things that I say. It's just, will you stand up and do those things? Again, everybody loves the police and waving the flag, and when officers or firemen are killed, you thank you, and the letters and the flowers, all that's great. But what about taking care of our families in the long term? I've been speaking with this gentleman on via email or calls, Armando Garza. He doesn't even know me. The man has never seen me in his life, but he is the only one that has really made any interest in wanting to meet with the police officers in person via his email that most of you are on. I think that's real leadership. I can't even get our representative, and believe me, I'm not the only one in this room that's listening to me talk. I'm just the one probably with the biggest mouth. But you guys need to do a better job. You tell me you can't answer questions. What month before last, you said, hey, this is not a Q&A. This is just you to make comment. But yet you make the rules up as you go along. Just now, Kelly answers a fireman's question, and I don't want to say this. Are these rules just for certain individuals and not for others? Either they're rules or they're not rules, guys.
Okay, thank you.
No, I'm not done. And per your rules, you can't stop me from talking. I have a list of things I want to mention, and you have to let me talk.
Well, there is a time limit.
I looked at your rules. I don't see anything in the rules or the parliamentary procedure that says anything about the amount of time. I have multiple things to mention to you that I want to make sure you're aware of. So are you telling me you're not going to let me have my mention these things to you? Please tell me that you're not treating me like this again.
No, what I'm saying is you got 5 minutes to cover whatever you want to cover at 8:40.
Well, I didn't see that in the rules. And I want to continue. If you cut me off, then you cut me off. But that was never in the rules and never mentioned. I want to mention also about I'm making contacts with the chairman of the House Pension Committee. I'm contacting the Pension Investments and Financial Services Committee. all nine members. I want to email all these folks need to know that we're not getting information from our board. You keep telling me you're working on it. You're working on it. This has gone on 5 months, and I haven't received anything. Mr. Mark Malvo said he wanted to come meet with us, but he refused to do so. Now he's putting it back on, I think, Kelly or other individuals. Don't make statements that you cannot back up, sir. Alan Vaught was going to mention with us. Now he's been moved on to the Veterans Committee or something to that effect. We need to find out what the purpose of these mayor appointees are and what are they going to do for us. I want to make sure you're clear about what I'm asking. We want in-person meetings at each station, starting at Northeast. The officers have no idea. They don't even know who our pension rep is for the DPD. None of them. This is all sounding too familiar from 10 years ago. We need information about the lawsuits. We are requesting that Kelly immediately hire staff, if necessary, and bring them up to speed, because she says she doesn't have enough people to do that, to come to the stations and talk to the officers about the pension and what was left of the drop. There are still many of us still old heads here who want to know information and want to be educated. Mr. Haben, again, needs to resign. He was not even give us information about the online classes. This is stuff you need to let us know. The laws need to be changed about this election process of who's on the board. You can't have a retiree representing us. But we're going to, my next step is going to be going to Austin to talk to these individuals who you're meeting with to let them know that we're not getting this information, that no one, that you refuse to come out and talk with us. You love the police? Let's see how much you like the police and fire. Do your jobs.
Okay, thank you. Was there another one there, John?
No, that's it.
Okay, let's move on to the next item on our agenda then, which is an update from me on the funding committee update. As we talked about early in the year, I think it was somewhere around January, the mayor asked Rob Walters and myself to put together a study group to look at a number of ways that we could put some really some significant funding into the plan to get us to a funding level that would be somewhere that would meet the requirements that the state had laid out for us in 2024. So to sort of get a head start on that process, we put together a group that included Joe Colonetta, Rick Porter, Ryan Bailey, and Cullum Clark. We've been really meeting with that group on and off pretty much every month. But the bulk of what we've been doing is working with a group called the Reasons Foundation. Reason Foundation is a nonprofit pro bono, which is important to, since we don't have a lot of funding sources. And they've worked with a lot of cities across the country on a variety of things. The guy who founded that company actually rewrote the legislation in Washington on how airports could be potentially sold and or leased by city entities. And so we've been working with them, and we're probably to the point where in August we think there'll be a report that lists a number of alternatives for the city to consider. We're hoping to have a meeting with the mayor in August, and those recommendations generally come down into four or five categories. The first is the sale or lease of airports. That clearly is the biggest item out there. DFW is worth probably to the city of Dallas $5 billion, and if you could get that, that would be worth it. The way it works now, any cash flow, excess cash flow generated by the airport has to stay at the airport. It does not come back to the city, so the city's not getting any benefit. So that's a major one, and the response we've got talking to city administrators at this point is that's something they would be considering, but recognizing we don't control it, that Fort Worth would have to be in agreement on something like that. So I think that's going to be highlighted as an issue to take on.
Can I ask just one question regarding that? When you talk about the sale and lease, are you also saying that maybe that you can change that stipulation where the money has to stay there, but maybe you can
No. Right now there's a very huge market of private investors, infrastructure investors who would be looking to acquire or lease this on a long-term basis. Just as I was coming in here today, I got a report from the Reasons Foundation, that Sydney Airport has significant number of bidders, and they're bidding like 25 to 30 times multiples on EBITDA to pay to them. So no, it would not be changing how the money could come. It would be whether or not you would change control.
Okay.
A secondary part of that would be Love Field. Love Field is worth probably a lot less in value. My guess would be closer to $1 billion, but we wouldn't have the Fort Worth entanglement. So that's probably high on the list of alternatives to be looked at. A second alternative to be looked at, which is minor, is really just changing our funding policy to be actuarially funded at the actuarially determined amount that's required. Part of the recent bill to bail out the employee retirement system down.
CEOs and founders of the data and analytics company, AppleCard.
The bailout of the ERS in the last legislature included a provision to fund at the actuarially required amount. That was also being done in New Jersey. So there's a number of that. That impact is about $20 million a year in addition to what we're getting now. So it would help, but it's not a major thing. We're also looking at, we're going to put on the list the pension obligation bond. Again, given low interest rates where they are, we think that is something that should be studied hard. Finance administrators tend to think that that's not best practice. So I think that may be a little harder to get done, but it's one of our recommendations that we take a look at that and consider that. The other two areas really are looking at any streams of revenue that the city may be getting that could be dedicated towards funding the plan. So things like parking revenues. I've got a meeting this afternoon with the guy in parking to find out just how much do we really get, and is there, you know, what value on the real estate, on lots, et cetera. A number of cities, Indianapolis and Chicago, both have done deals and have gotten significant amounts of either revenue stream and or capital. Some of them have been done poorly. Chicago's been criticized as having given away the shop. Indianapolis is sort of the model out there now, so, you know, they'll be taking a look at that. And the other one is we're looking at is sort of sanitation as well, you know. The value of privatizing that asset, is there a value there? The big value, as I see it today, or what I'm told by industry experts, is that Dallas has a landfill out with the 24-year life. They're just closing one big landfill. They got another one. And with the 24-year life, that's a valuable asset to people like Waste Management or Republic or other people would be very interested in. So we're taking a look, and I think those will sort of comprise the bulk of the recommended alternatives for the city to consider. The next step would be for the mayor to look at it, decide what he thinks is viable, work with the city manager, and start studying some of these processes. And again, I think the goal was always to have a plan that we could go to the 2023 legislature and say, this is how we think we're going to solve the problem and get us from 40% funded or whatever the number is now to, in the least, into the 70s, if not above that.
Bill, so does DFW just sort of retain surplus cash flow on their balance sheet, and or do you know kind of how that works and what they do with that?
They also use it for capital investments,
sure,
and doing some of that stuff. But generally, they get to retain that asset. They pay down debt. They do capital improvements. They fund their operating budget. But that's generally what it is. But no, we're prohibited under federal law from getting any of that dividend that it affects back to the city.
How is that federal law? I mean, is that
it's under FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration on administration of airports, has all these rules, and it's been rewritten as recently as, I want to say, 3 or 4 years ago. At that time, there was a limit as to how many airports could even be sold. Now that's been taken off, so more airports could be sold now, but they have the right to govern the system that way.
Okay. Are they, is there a lot of leverage at the DFW airport level, or do you know?
There's, I mean, and one of the requirements when you do any of these things is to eliminate the debt. The existing bondholders would have to all be paid off because they have certain covenants and promises. And you also got to get the airlines on board, but I think the airlines around the country have concluded that airports can be run more efficiently by private sources than public sources. So they have approved and San Juan's case, there was a case in St. Louis. There's been a number of them where the airlines have gone ahead and agreed to doing this. I think our biggest hurdle would be Fort Worth. And, they've got a change in their political organization now with new mayor and new city council, so I don't know where they are. But that wouldn't be the first thing.
Do they have a pension funding issue at all?
Yes, they do. They've got, I think, $1 billion shortfall on their pension funds.
Well, another idea, and this is what the Triborough Bridge did back, is that with Robert Moses, is that they guaranteed bonds for all these other things. Is there any possibility of doing a bond guaranteed by the airport that would be used for the benefit of the pension?
I'm not aware of it, but I'll
maybe
take a look.
Maybe something to work out. That's what Robert Moses did with the Triborough Bridge Authority.
Did they really?
He backed all these bonds for all these other projects for decades.
Did you actually get through that book?
It's an awesome book.
I'm like halfway. Can I get through it?
Which one is it?
The Power Broker.
What is it again?
Power Broker.
Okay, any other questions? That's sort of my update on that.
Just to summarize real quick, three big buckets, one DFW, another one the POB, and then look at other revenue streams within the city.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And then we think the funding thing we should do anyway. I mean, we're going to recommend that they go ahead and fund on an actual basis in addition to...
Hey, Bill, this is Mark Malvo. One question I have, and I think those are all interesting options, but at the end of the day, I'm wondering whether what you really need in terms of revenue streams, and it may not be palatable in some sense, but wouldn't a possible opportunity be to get some legislation to where there actually could be, like you were saying, in terms of revenue streams, possibly a one-time tax, whether that be property or sales or other form of fee that can be used to deal with this? That would seem to me, and I don't know if the group has thought of that, but to provide the legislature to give the city or the pension board the opportunity to find some form of fee or tax that could be used to fill this hole.
Yeah, no, we hadn't talked about that. I mean, we've been trying to avoid a specific tax to do this, but that's worth us thinking about and possibly adding to the list. Thanks, Mark. Okay, so I would hope that we're going to be meeting with the mayor sometime in August to kick this off, so then the city's going to have a lot of analysis and a lot of work to start to ferret through these things. So that's where we are on that project. So thank you. And with that, we're going to move to the portfolio update. Ryan's going to cover that with us.
Okay, thank you, Bill. Leo, Aaron, are you guys on yet?
Yes, this is Leo. Good morning.
Okay, thanks, Leo.
I'm here too.
All right, appreciate it, guys. I'm going to start with some highlights for the quarter and then move into the investment items on the agenda. We ended the quarter with $1.99 billion in adjusted NAV. On the private market side, we had another productive quarter with $30 million in distributions coming back. In the last year, we reduced the private market's allocation from $832 million down to just over $660 now. That reduction in the illiquid assets has in part given us the luxury to consider some asset allocation mixes later today that shift $120 million or 6% from the safety reserve and the short-term core bonds over to the equity portfolio. And as part of the increase to the equity allocation we're looking at, we're going to consider adding a new manager to the U.S. small cap space later today. We have a recommendation there. And then we added some new slides on public performance. Year to date, we're up 7.7% on the public portfolio, 1.6% over the public benchmark of the 60-40 portfolio. You see that the equity portfolio is performing quite well, up 13%. Fixed income's been pretty protective. Benchmark's down 3%. Fixed income's up 0.6% year to date. On the allocation, with the money coming back from private markets and investment growth we've seen in the equity portfolio, we're up to 38% in global equity, and that's up from 23% allocation to equities 2 years ago. So moving through the rest of the portfolio update, you can see the adjusted NAV, as I mentioned, $1.99 billion. The adjustment of $46 million that we're still taking relates to the Lone Star assets and mainly to Lone Star and the private equity portfolio. We expect to book that adjustment probably by the end of July, maybe into August. So I think once we have that adjustment booked for year end, and private equity will stop having to do the adjusted NAV and just have one reported NAV to you guys, which makes things a little bit simpler, and knowing there's still some downside risk in the private equity portfolio as it relates to valuation.
The $46 million adjustment here is the one you're going to be booking?
Yeah, 95% of that relates to the one we're booking. There's a few other small adjustments to other private equity assets, but I think they're immaterial relative to the overall portfolio, and it's a little bit simpler just to go to the reported NAV once we book the big one. So on a go-forward basis, we're going to show prior month performance in the public portfolio to give you guys a snapshot, and then, again, show the year-to-date performance against the 60/40 to give a bit more real-time view of how the public portfolio has been performing.
Most of our managers are doing pretty well on this.
Yeah, I mean, you can see kind of the continued value outperformance relative to growth in the equity portfolio year-to-date. The only one that's really underperforming is RBC so far, and that's due to their style. Also added this chart, which is the periodic table of asset class returns, just to give the board a reminder of the cyclicality we've seen across asset classes. Year to date, top performing asset classes are REIT, commodities, small cap. And if you look at the second to last column there, it shows 2006 to 2020. Annualized returns, and if you look kind of mid of that chart, you can see the kind of longer-term underperformance of EM equity and international relative to U.S. and large cap.
Ryan, so just to kind of frame, you know, $2 billion is a nice round number where everyone can kind of conceptualize. How much of the $2 billion are in private assets that you would, you know, call legacy, or ones that, you know, we're trying to work our way out of, versus those that we're happy and, you know, pleased to be seeing a compounding rate of return in, just to sort of frame it for everybody?
So the stuff we plan to keep long term, we have a 5% allocation to ag.
Yeah.
$80 million, we plan to keep that.
Okay, but just what's the number of sort of legacy, so everyone can kind of conceptualize over a denominator of $2 billion? Mm.
The legacy assets are $370 million right now.
Okay, so a shade under 20% is in things that we want to move out of that asset class and reallocate it into a more normalized, you know, portfolio. And in a sense, would it be fair to say that that percentage is somewhat of a drag on overall returns right now versus where we want to be?
Correct. In that 20%, we model that out at 0% return, and that's how we get to the ramp up to 7% or 6.75 or 6.5 where we end up. Of the legacy, about over half is the red portfolio in real estate, and that's performing quite well, but we still need to get out of that portfolio, and it's going to take some time. And then the other third is the zombie private equity and the legacy private equity that is more concerning than the red portfolio.
Yeah. I think it's important for everyone to kind of see that on a year-to-date basis, 7.7% on the allocation that essentially this, you know, the revised board with staff has sort of underwritten over the last couple of years, and it also highlights, you know, how important and how prudent it's been to monetize out of that number that's 20% now that was much higher before. But not to do so in a way where we unduly, you know, take write-offs and hits and things like that. So it's a managing a bunch of dials, but I think it's important for everyone to see that there is this a piece that has now become a very significant piece of a good, solid long-term allocation that is performing well. We're talking about, you know, hurdle rates that are 7%, maybe lower. You know, you can see that for this time period, we surpassed that hurdle rate. And so it's always good to sort of recognize what we're doing well and how we're positioning ourselves today to do even better in the future. And taking care of business on the allocation today, then monetizing out of these legacy assets, but not doing so where we're taking an undue hit in order to put that money into the productive bucket where we feel like we have a good long-term plan.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I mean, the legacy allocation was 45% 2 years ago, and private markets as well, about 50. So
yeah,
we made quite a bit of progress getting that lowered. And I'll get into it a little bit later, but on the private market side, we're seeing the distributions come back that we expected, and given the market, we're starting to see some surprises come back as well.
Good.
So year to date, $76 million in distributions. I expect about another $25 million to come back, one real estate sale and a few other bit more proceeds coming back from RED by mid-August. We'll talk a little bit more about the private equity funds later today in closed session. And then, as I mentioned, we have the recommendation on the U.S. small cap manager today. We did an RFP process, received those back early May, and then we took the finalist interviews to the IAC late June. We'll look forward on investment initiatives on the quarterly plan. After we approve the asset allocation today, we come back in August with an update to the investment policy that has updated asset allocation targets, ranges, and implementation plan. We just launched internally the search process for the international small cap manager to pair with the U.S. small cap. We have a call with Makita to get their thoughts on managers in the next couple of weeks here. In September, we plan to bring a global equity structure review back to the board based on the increased allocation to the asset class, just looking at how we're going to allocate that within equity at the higher allocation. And then we're in the process of doing a review on the emerging market equity manager, RBC, right now to see if we're comfortable with them being the sole, potentially the sole manager in that space. On calendar, we're going to get back into some of the reviews across the portfolio next month with infrastructure and then look at the public side of the portfolio into the fall. Any additional questions there? If not, we can move into the asset allocation item.
Let's go ahead.
Okay. So on asset allocation, it's our third attempt at this, and I'm glad we've taken our time given how important this decision will be. We took our original recommendations to the board in May. Based on feedback of that meeting, we came back last month and did an education piece on emerging markets equity and then showed two additional mixes that got closer to a market weight in equity to emerging markets. So today we're going to seek approval on one of the long-term mixes, and then I'll talk about implementation, how we get there, how long it takes, and how we plan to implement that reduction to the safety reserve. So with that, Leo, Aaron, over to you guys to review the mixes.
Thank you, Ryan, and good morning, everybody. To not repeat what Ryan just stated, I'll just start making some comments, and if you need to point to a slide, I'm looking at the second slide in our presentation that has the table. Let me see if I can find the page. Yeah, that's correct. Thank you. So essentially, when we met in May, there was agreement generally about the risk-return posture, and there were some questions about what the ultimate allocation to emerging markets should be. So the first three columns with numbers come from prior work, and mixes C and D are new and have reduced exposure to emerging markets equity. The current targets, 50% to total equities, 40-10, the split between global and emerging, and you will recall that your global equity managers hold some emerging market exposure. So we're using the current as a basis for the future, and we look passed in the back, and it hasn't been a lot of changes. I think it's a pretty good assumption, but it is an assumption nonetheless. If you were to go to...
One comment I mentioned to Ryan yesterday. We should footnote in the global equity how much emerging market exposure already exists there. I think we've talked about the fact that there's probably 7%, I believe. So, I just think it's a little misleading when we just show emerging market equity as one number and global equity that is inclusive of a big chunk of that so that we have a perspective on what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and I think maybe we could add to the quarterly reports, too, just a full look through every quarter to show the geographic allocation.
Yeah.
Fully allocated, I think it's going to be right around 6% expected EM in the global equity bucket.
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay, if we move to the next page, here we have some similar data on the front, on the top, on the top chart. And we look at the expected returns of these portfolios, and the first takeaway is there's not that much that changes. Emerging markets in our models, and I think most other consultants, have somewhat greater expected returns, but also with greater volatility or risk. So when you look at Sharpe ratios, they don't change too much. So it's not that impactful, if you were to go from the highest allocation to emerging markets to the lowest, which is mixed D, which is essentially market weight. That 5% change from 10 to 5 reduces return by about 10 basis points, but also reduces volatility so that, again, the risk-adjusted return remains the same. On the next page, we get into the comment that Bill just made about, okay, what is it, when we aggregate everything that we own, how much do we own across in our equities that would be qualified as emerging economies? The benchmark that we use is the ACWI IMI, and that is an 88-12 split. So mixed B, the original one, had an overweight, and that was purposely so. Mixed C and D reduced that overweight all the way to essentially get a market weight at mixed D. Keep in mind, again, the following assumptions. Number one is we assume 7% to each global equity manager. If we were to increase that to, say, 8%, then there would be a lower weight to emerging markets overall in each of these mixes. Ryan also mentioned if the allocation ends up being over 5% to emerging markets, you may well consider adding a complementary manager at least to the current holding that you have with RBC. We're not going to get ahead of ourselves, but that's something that is going to be reviewed. Regardless, it's going to be re-underwritten the investment you have with RBC in the next month or two. If you go to the next page, here we have a table. Yeah,
let's hold off on the probability stuff until we get into the assumed rate of return discussion. That's okay. Unless there's any kind of points you wanted to make that relate to the long-term mix, I think we want to kind of decide where we're going there, then get into implementation, and then move on to what that means for the assumed rate of return.
Okay, then let me then pause here and just make one final comment. Mikita is comfortable with all of these three mixes. Today, you have an underweight to emerging market in both equity and debt. The plan is to continue to grow those. The question is to what level. We're comfortable even if we were to go to the smallest allocation, which is mixed D. It's an improvement from where we are today, and this gets revisited every couple of years at most. So we think that is the trend in the right direction. And as we saw earlier from those probability charts, the difference is pretty small. It's on the margin. So I'll pause there and happy to take any questions on this matter before we get into, probabilities and assumed rate of returns.
So where are we now then, Ryan? Do you want
to? I think we should try to get a, I don't know if we need to take a vote, but can't get approval now on the MIC and then go into implementation, but at least have a sense of which one of these mixes the board prefers, and then we can get into the rest of the presentation on allocation. So our recommendation is still the same from May, the mix B with the overweight to EM. We haven't changed that. We're supportive, and we've been hurt a while with the overweight. I think the feedback we've heard from the board is a market weight makes more sense. And what Bill said in May really resonated with, given the small return differential, why do something that makes us look, you know, take an outside bet on an asset class, given what we're going through from a funding standpoint with the city. So staff is comfortable going all the way down to mix D. I think the factor there we're looking at is, are we okay with a full 5% to RBC? From an allocation and policy perspective, we've taken this overweight to EM in the allocation on paper, but we've never fully allocated there yet. So I think any increase to get, you know, we're below a market weight now, anything that moves us towards getting to a market weight and then potentially above at some point down the road, we're supportive of, but mixed D gets us moving in that direction.
My thought and what I expressed in May, and I think it's still true, is, you know, part of what got us in some of the areas of difficulty is taking a more aggressive approach than the world. So I think staying closer to the index with a 12%, 7 in global and 5 separately makes sense. And the fact emerging markets have done very well recently, so this is probably not the time to be changing. So moving from where we are to a market weighting, I think, does make sense. But to go beyond that, I'd have a little pause. So, I mean, I would move that we adopt mixed D then to do that. If we need an approval to the long-term asset allocation and direct the staff. So any just further discussion before we would vote on that?
Hey, Bill, if that was a motion, this is Gilbert, I would second it. I think the marginal difference is so small, it's not worth the exposure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we at the June 28th IAC meeting, we went back and briefed them on where we were at and the feedback we got in May and what we did in June. So IAC is fully informed of these mixes and our likely outcome, which we assume going into this is C or D.
Okay. So I motioned it. Gilbert, you seconded. Any further discussion? No.
Well, one thing. Do we know in this global context what is the percentage of, like, let's say, U.S. outside or emerging within that context?
Yeah, they're saying 12% or so is about where emerging is outside. On the
not outside, but within.
So,
you know what I'm saying?
Leo, do you know, like, the breakdown, I think this might be your question, and the benchmark between U.S., international, and we know EM 12, but what is the U.S. and international split? On that benchmark?
Yeah, Ryan. This is Aaron. So the biggest bucket is obviously U.S., and that's around 57%. Then you've got 31% in developed, non-U.S., and then 12% is the remainder in EM.
Okay.
And then, Aaron, if you've got that, how much in the EM is China? China's become a big part of the EM allocation, I believe.
Yeah, it's the biggest. I mean, off the top of my head, it's almost half. It's probably around 40% of EM.
Of the EM equity?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about the.
Yeah, it's been bigger. Yeah. And there are a lot of issues there, too, with security issues. So I don't think, you know, so the motion was then basically keep it at the mixed D so that we wouldn't be overweighted beyond that. Okay, Gilbert, you seconded. Any other further discussion before we vote? Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, Kara, so there is your direction. And we're directing, part of that motion is to direct you to bring back
adjustments to
the investment policy.
We're going to rewrite the
to reflect these changes.
Appendix with the allocation and then have to tweak that implementation section as well. So I'm going to move into implementation and how we plan to get to the updated allocation. So two issues here we've been thinking about is how quickly should we move to implement that 6% or $120 million reduction in the safety reserve. Naturally, cash outflows just from the $9 million a month in benefit payments, would take a...
Ryan, for the people on the phone, Ryan's on page 38.
Okay.
People are on the phone. reference the pages, please.
Sorry, yeah, I didn't know. No. I'll be back in the office and knowing what you guys are looking at. So 38, we moved ahead into the implementation, still in the asset allocation presentation. So it would take a year to do that naturally just by paying benefits out of the safety reserve. What we're recommending doing is implementing that reduction by the end of the year, 2021. Reasonable amount of time to transition. It would take a combination of natural depletion from benefit payments and then reinvestment into the liquid asset classes, about half and half. So $54 million would come from paying benefits at the $9 million a month, and then $61 million would come out to reallocate into the liquid asset classes. We've targeted a 3% reduction by the end of Q3 and then the full 6% by the end of the year. We're going to initiate monthly withdrawals from IRM, which is the short-term core bond manager. We looked at it, it's about 16 a month on average to get there. To fund the help fund the U.S. small cap manager, we'll probably do a bigger distribution or liquidation in the first month and then do equal monthly amounts so they know kind of what's coming on how we're getting down to their new allocation. So any questions or feedback on timing?
Staff recommendation sounds reasonable.
Okay. And then the other part of it is where do we want to put the money as money's coming back into the portfolio and the safe reserve reallocation. What we're recommending doing is just do a pro rata equal amounts into EM equity, EM debt, and global equity. So if we have $60 million to redeploy at the end of August, we would take $20 million to EM equity, $20 million to EM debt, and then fill up global equity pro rata. It would take $33 million to get to target, at the 5% target to EM equity, $40 million to get to the target in EM debt, and then excess amounts would go to fill up global equity force allocation. We're basically fully allocated to fixed income right now, and then that would get it fully allocated everywhere but the global equity allocation.
Great. Okay.
Any questions? So we'll come back with the proposed changes to the IPS to reflect long-term allocation and then implementation as well.
Great. Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Next, Kelly, are you going to lead the discussion on the actuarial valuation? Or?
Yes, I will.
Do you want the clicker? Or?
Sure. Caitlin, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am on.
Okay. Thank you for being here. Caitlin Griss is with Siegel. Jeff is not able to attend today, and Caitlin's really here for your questions that I can't answer. At the June board meeting, we talked about Jeff was on the phone, and he went through a memo that he provided on both Siegel's recommendations for the actuarial valuation and also specifically the impact of on the fund if we choose to lower the assumed rate of return or the discount rate. And Siegel's recommendation for the actuarial valuation that's in process now for all of the assumptions that are used in the valuation, except for this discount rate item, is to use the same assumptions that they used in the prior year valuation. And I support that recommendation. They did a big experience study. If you recall, we adjusted a lot of those assumptions at the time, and we don't have any data to tell us those numbers are and those numbers or assumptions are wrong. So I wouldn't change anything else. But we did ask them to look at the discount rate and what would happen if we lowered that. And there's a memo that was provided. It's on page, the memo starts on page 44. My mouse does not change that.
There it is.
It's right here. And this chart goes through, this is what I was referring to earlier when I was answering Mr. Williams' question. The first column of numbers is the January 1, 2020 valuation, and again, that's an old valuation. So when we get the new valuation, these numbers will be probably lower. That's what we're expecting, and that was what was planned when the 2017 legislation was passed. And then the four columns to the right show what that valuation would have looked like under different discount rates. So you can see there is an impact, as you would expect, to the funding ratio and also the required contribution amount, which is one of the scenarios that Bill talked about as a recommendation to the city, so it's important to look at that as well. In the Makita presentation, there was a slide where they talked about the probability of making certain returns over time. And in their analysis, and they can certainly talk about this better than I can, basically for the first 10 years, the next 10 years, their projections are that we will earn, that the market will earn less than the 20-year period. And we have seen in our plan, and we know from the actuary, that early bad news hurts DPFP a lot more than later bad news. And because of that, I really recommend that we lower the discount rate probably to 6.5. I don't honestly know if 6.75 or 6.5 is the right number, but what I do know is early bad news hurts us. We have these legacy private equity investments that probably are more likely to have bad news than good news. And we know that on a monthly basis we have a net benefit outflow issue, which isn't going to reverse itself for many years. So I would recommend that the board consider lowering the discount rate to 6.5%. And what that would do is under the 2020 valuation, the funding ratio would go from 45.73% to 43.36%. Each quarter point change is about 115 to 120 basis point reduction in the funding value. On line 7 of this chart here, the recommended contribution rate as a percentage of projected payroll is listed there. And that's an important number because the committee bill talked about, sounds like they're going to recommend to the city that they pay the required contribution amount. This shows that under the current status with a 7% return, the recommended contribution rate is 46.71%. And when I did an analysis earlier in the year, actually, for the committee that Bill was talking about, the current amount that the city is contributing is about 43%. So they're about 3.71% short. And that 43% is a combination of the floor plus this extra $13 million a year that they provide. The floor will actually go up again in 2022, but then in 2023 and 2024 it declines, and the $13 million drops off after 2024 and the floor goes completely away. So if we do lower the discount rate and the city funds at that level, if we lower it, I mean, even if they just funded at that level based on the 2020 valuation, it's about 3.7% more than they're paying now. And then if we went to all the way down to 6.5%, it would be another 7% or almost 8% of what they're actually paying today. But that would never drop off as they're expecting to happen in after 2024. Does that make sense? Are there questions?
Oh, can you clarify?
Sure.
So when you say the recommended contribution, mm-hmm. it achieves what outcome? What is it, when you say, what outcome does it achieve by funding at that level?
It makes the plan fully funded in 30 years. Is that correct, Caitlin?
I believe so. And because you guys changed the funding policy last year, I believe, to,
right.
I think it's 25 years now.
Right, we did. You're right. Well, I forgot we changed the funding policy. Before, we had to, for the PRB, fund it in 30 years. So it actually may be shorter than that, because we have a layered funding policy where we do, maybe you're right, it could be 25, and
I think
two layers are over 10 or 15 years.
Yes.
Came out that we had to overlap that. Have we ever lowered the rate by 0.5% before in one shot? Or
we lowered it 1.25 when we went from 8.5 to 7.25.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So this is a big change, but I think it's important if the city and the committee and the public is looking at how do we solve this pension issue, we don't want to think that we've solved the pension issue, then come back a short period of time later and say we need to lower the discount rate again. So I think although this is painful and it's going to make the plan funding look worse, we want the plan funding level to look as accurate as possible. And because of the headwinds that we have, it seems to me the 6.5 might be the right answer.
How much incrementally will it increase the liability on the city by doing that?
The unfunded actuarial liability based on the 2020 valuation, I think, is line 3, so $300 million, roughly, $250 million is the unfunded liability.
Any thoughts?
It would be good, even if it's estimates or some, to get this brought to the most current forward date possible. Ryan mentioned that the investment portfolio is right around $2 billion right now, right? Right?
Yep.
Okay. Here it says $2.16 billion. So even if it's using estimates or preliminary numbers, it would be good for us to see this with the most recent. I'm for it, but it just isn't but I think that would be helpful to see that at some point going forward.
So when we do that, and Caitlin, you can explain the amount of work, if we go, because we've actually done this in the past where we tell Siegel, oh, the asset numbers are final, go do your work. And they do the valuation and they do all the calculations, which is like an incredible amount of work. And then we say, oh, we got this new valuation or this change, do it again. And we know that just a lot of work and it's kind of expensive. Caitlin, can you talk about what are your feelings about us running this now with an estimated asset value and then truing it up once we get the valuations from Huff and Lone Star?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with you. It's kind of, we try to do as much as we can up to the point of, you know, kind of not dropping in the assets, but kind of one of the tricky factors here is the COLA. I hate to point to that, but, you know, once we get your assets, we have to back into when the COLA is expected to start because you have to get to that, you know, you said 70% funding level. So we kind of don't like to go down that road until, you know, we're sure assets are final or as close to final as possible, so we're not having to kind of back into that COLA start date multiple times. Unfortunately, it's not a small amount of work, and the plan is a little trickier than others in that regard.
You weren't suggesting that they redo the valuation. Say, let's be a little more conservative on the discount rate.
What I'm saying is this, is that
we know
we're looking at a market value funded ratio, if we go to 6.5, of 41.31. Okay, that's what it says here. What I think would be not good oversight on our part would be that we say yes to the 6.5, and then when numbers are put in that are more current, we find out that it's not 41.31, it's 35 or 36 or something like that. We say, oh, so I didn't understand. You say, well, those were using old numbers. And so I think that in conjunction with what Bill's committee is doing and so on, that it's just good governance for us to know approximately where that number is with this change.
Right. And I think I understand that, and I guess
I think you can calculate. I mean, the actuarial liability is $4,981,000, and if we got $2 billion—that's
what it was 18 months ago.
At the 6.5%.
So the problem becomes calculate. It's not the asset side that's the problem. I need to talk to Siegel to see how material this is, because maybe it doesn't end up being that material. We could give them a new asset number today and tell them, you know, run it based on this, ignore the COLA impact, ignore any additional change related to the COLA and tell us where we are. And I think that would be much easier because the COLA impacts the liability side And that's where, does it come in 5 years later or sooner or later? And that's the number that they have to, it sounds like, manually tweak on when they put that COLA in.
Can I just say something?
We can get close enough.
Couldn't the assumption be that it's going to be below whatever is being reported here? But it, I think to Nick's point, it's like how much, what's the magnitude with a small change and using that first. I mean, I think that's what it is, because if it says 41-something and it's actually 39, let's say, realistically, that's kind of, I don't know, hard.
Yeah, I just think that we have to know what fundamental tools do we need in our toolkit as we move forward on discussions. And in my mind, that if we're going to go to 6.5, we need to know that what does that mean with current numbers as an imputed funded ratio, because that's such the most easy to understand, all-encompassing metric that there is. And I mean, if I'm, Bill's committee goes and talks to the mayor and he goes, well, where do we stand? You know, you don't want to say, to give him a number that is 18 months and going to 24 months old. You want to say, especially with all the changes that have happened, good returns, movement, and then I think right after that, if you're going to say that the recommended contribution amount versus the 43%, which 43% is a real number. That's a today's number, right?
Yes.
Okay. So if you're going to draw a comparison to an aspirational number you'd like for the city to consider, you want to be able to say that from 43 now, it would need to go to X in order to get us on the glide path to be fully funded, and we want to confirm it's 25 years versus 30 years. And so I just think those are fundamental tools that we need in our toolkit in order to be effective, do effective governance here and effective communicators externally.
I 100% agree with you that when we're talking to the city and to the members in the community about the funding and the impacts and all that, we need to have the best information we can. However, I think picking the right number to put this assumption at shouldn't be driven by what these results are. It should be driven by what you think the right number is.
No, I agree with that. So I'm not saying it drives the decision, but it drives the communication of the decision.
I agree.
So I just think that a current funded number using some element of estimate, to me, makes more sense than using a fully vetted, footed number that is a year and a half going to 2 years old.
Right. I agree with you. Caitlin, is there, I mean, you don't have to come up with something on the spot, but is there a way for Siegel to get us something close that we can use if we give you an asset number that doesn't require as much work?
Yeah, I think we can, especially if we, obviously here we kind of gave you a range of four different discount rates. It sounds like, 6.75 and 6.5 is closer to where you are. So we can come up with a better estimate than this. Like I said, our liability numbers for 2021 are underway. It's kind of the asset piece is the last piece, and we can try and, come up, I guess, with a more up-to-date estimate. It's obviously not going to be a final number yet, but we can definitely do that.
What is the timing issue on this then? We need to get this done for the audit?
Yeah, we need to get this done for the audit, and as you know, we're always delayed on the audit because of HUP primarily. And if HUP came in tomorrow, we'd be kicking ourselves that we don't have this decision. But HUP can never come in.
But I've been here. But changing that and getting the results shouldn't change the idea of getting more conservative assumption rate.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, getting any granular information on the overarching is that we saw what happened with just one bad year in March of 2020 and how it affected everything. So just to make the assumption that in the next 10 years, which is more critical than the next 20 years, all we need is one more event like that to just kind of throw the whole apple cart off filter. So I mean, to your point, that if we meet an assumption rate that really reflects the situation, that doesn't change no matter how we change these components.
Right.
And where would the 6.5 put us relative to other public funds? Do we?
I knew you were going to ask that question, so I brought that.
I think I asked that last month. Mm-hmm. With legal, I mean, I think most of their clients were at 6.5,
right,
from what I remember.
So let me.
Caitlin, is that true? Do you know?
I have the information.
Sorry.
So I'll ask your question in a second, but I want to ask Caitlin and your first question. Caitlin, if we put this decision off until our August board meeting, will that delay your work? If the board agrees that all the other assumptions are going to remain the same, but we don't know on this assumption, what will be the impact on you?
So I guess I would kick it back to you and say, do you think we'll have final assets before that anyway?
No.
Because we're kind of, you know, we're kind of at a standstill until we get those as it is. So I guess I'd say it'll delay us if we don't have final, if we have final assets and then need to wait on the discount rate assumption. It won't delay us if we're waiting on assets next time.
Okay, but there's no other work you need to be doing right now that isn't waiting on the assets, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, that's great. So we don't have to make the decision this month. We can do that other piece. So the answer to your second question was, in Texas, the Pension Review Board has 99 pension plans. Of those 99 pension plans, the median rate is 7.25, the mean rate 7.14. There are 11 plans below 6.5. There are 10 plans between 6.5 and 7, 24 plans at 7, 17 between 7 and 7.5, 23 at 7.5, 12, well, 14 above that, two of which are even above 8.
Wow, that's surprising. I would have thought it would be coming down. You said last month you thought Siegel said their average experience is closer to 6.5.
No, I thought they were more like 7.
Mm-hmm.
We're low. According to Makito, 6.5 would be low for Makito's plan.
One thing in my unactuarial observations over the years, the Texas plans have always been higher generally than the rest of the country. So as Texas plans have come down, they have come down, but they started out so high that they're still, I think, higher generally than the national average, you might guess.
I mean, I get the sense we don't want to delay things, but if we're not delaying anything to get it, the information at 6.5 probably makes sense for the board to act more sensibly next month.
Okay.
But I think that
But we'll get you your data.
I think that two initiatives. One is just what it means from a funded ratio standpoint. Once again, not to drive whether 6.5, it's not a driver, it's a consequence, but it's a consequence we should be aware of.
Yeah.
But the other one is that I think that a combination of staff, Siegel, and Makita needs to say, we think 6.5 is the right number, and that's our recommendation because of what?
Okay.
And to say that we believe that's either where the market is for comparable funds, that's where we believe the market is moving for comparable funds. So yes, maybe we see the momentum going this way because of, you know, where long-term interest rates are and swap rates and all, you know, discount rates and all those sorts of things. So that to me is a driver of picking the right number, whereas the work on the funded ratio is just a consequence that we should be aware of as we're opining on what the number ought to be, but not a driver of what the right number is.
Okay, I understand.
And I'm just out of curiosity, as an anomaly, is there any pension that are actually increasing their funded rates? Assumption rate?
I haven't seen that in years.
That's my point.
I have not seen that in years at all.
Okay, so we're all just talking about the degree of just reducing it.
And even
reducing or not, and to what degree?
Right,
yes.
Reducing
yes.
or not. That's what I don't mean to get off subject, but.
And even in the Siegel data, they do show the prior evaluation number, and so In the prior valuation, there were 6 plans above 8. Now there's 2. There was 23 plans between 7.5 and 8. Now there's 12. So people are going down. I hear what you're saying. We can do that. I think all that makes sense.
Okay, good.
And I'll probably answer my own question here, but there's probably no help in putting more pressure on Huff to get the results back any quicker, are there?
No.
And that was going to be my answer. I figured I'd bring it up.
It's been frustrating for us for several years. They just don't move.
They got worse because when I was on the board previously, we were talking generally around June, July, they would get it back to us. Now they're worse.
Now they're September.
September and October.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Okay, good. So we'll take that up next month. Okay, next is Gilbert and Ryan report on the Investment Advisory Committee.
Gilbert, you want to start with recap?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and start. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Bill. So the Investment Advisory Committee met twice. One time we were shy of quorum, but we had many players. It's just the nuance of how a quorum is defined on the Investment Advisory Committee. And then the second time with a full quorum and actually full membership to finalize our selection vote and recommendation to this board, the full board. And there was a really good process done by the staff, and Makita was very helpful, starting with a very wide net. Ryan will go through that. They then interviewed just a handful. I was pleased that a diverse firm was part of that, potentially two, depending upon how you define diverse, but certainly one. And then it came down to two finalists, and there were, of course, pluses and minuses to both. Makita was very clear that they were okay with either choice. And even the first meeting, we went with the firm that we'll be bringing forward today. And then the second meeting, we just reaffirmed it even more. So having said that, Ryan, why don't you go ahead and take it on the details and just review the process along the way. I think the board would enjoy that.
Okay.
Just before you do that, I would just point out that Gilbert has his picture twice in T&I this week. he's featured both on the front page and in a back page. So he was part of a panel that covered some of these diversity issues. So congratulations, Gilbert.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thanks, Gilbert. I'm going to start with the recommendation on the small cap core manager, and then we'll get into the process, get Makita's views on the two firms, and then answer any questions from the board on the recommendation. So we're recommending hiring Moody Aldridge, Eastern Shore, small cap core manager. And Moody Aldridge is the parent company. Eastern Shore is the name of the investment manager. They're a smaller but growing firm. They have $937 million in AUM. That's up from 220 5 years ago, so they've been growing pretty quickly.
I'm sorry, what was the AUM?
Right now, it's, firm AUM is 940. The strategy is 911. So they have like $20 million in a SMID product, too. It'd be a separate account. We're looking at an ultimate allocation here of $80 million, 4% of the plan. I think we'll kind of ease them up as we build out the equity portfolio. Right now, in the global equity structure, the target to small cap is 3, but going from 40% up to 55, I think we're going to take that up to 4. They run a portfolio that's pretty close to core. It has a quality bias to it, which kind of exhibits a slight growth tilt. We were really impressed throughout the process with their transparency and responsiveness to us in the RFP, their explanations, the interview calls, their presentation to the IC. We like that the management team, there's 3 portfolio managers on the team, and those are the only 3 investment staff making decisions. They're solely, they get the $30 million at SMID, but they run a small cap firm, and that's their focus. They don't run 10 other products that are U.S., global, and across the market cap spectrum. They really focus on small cap, and they have been for a long time. So I'm going to get into a little bit on the process. We expect to do funding. Looking at the contracting right now, I think we can get to funding at the end of this month, maybe into early August if we get approval today on the recommendation. I'll circle up on the process and then come back on any questions you guys might have.
What's the term? What's the fees?
The fees are
71 basis points.
71 basis points blended.
Blended.
Yeah. So it's a tiered structure. We haven't shown it in open session just for, you know, to have it out there. But yeah, it's 71 blended. Competitive. It was the third lowest bid we got out of the seven. So we're happy with where we got them to on those. So process-wise, this is the first, only the second search we've done with the new board and the first search we've done since we've gotten on the eVestment platform, which is a manager database tool. So that really helped staff scan the universe and run some reports internally without having to rely on Makita for everything. They were extremely helpful through the process, but I like being able to look at the universe and narrow it down and then bring managers to the table to talk to Makita with or about as well. So in the universe, U.S. small cap, there's 640. We ran some screens in eVestment, narrowed that down to 56. Makita brought a list of 10 names for us to review. Through a couple calls with the research team, we got it down to 7 names for the RFP shortlist listed here. Gilbert, as Gilbert mentioned, one or possibly two are minority firms. We got responses back from the RFP in mid-May and then spent some time internally with staff grading them and then making a cut down to 4 to do interviews with. So we had interviews with hour-long Zoom calls with 4 of the firms. After that, it was kind of a consensus top 2 between staff and Makita to interview or to bring the finalists of GW and K and Eastern Shore to the ISC. They did the interviews with the ISC on the 24th, and as Gilbert mentioned, they made the final recommendation on the 28th. Show you a few things on the comparison between the two. GW&K is a much bigger firm. They have $3.2 billion in small cap core compared to the $9.11 billion we're talking about with Eastern Shore. They're nearing capacity at GW&K. What we liked about them is they were pretty close or closer to a true core style. You know, like I said, we had a little bit of higher conviction with the team with Eastern Shore and a higher comfort level, but being only one manager in this space for this mandate, we did factor in the growth tilt over the core style of GW&K. Few points that came out at the IAC discussion around these two was the view that we all like the smaller size of Eastern Shore and their focus on small cap. We reviewed the correlation of Eastern Shore with the 4-5 active managers that we currently have in the portfolio, and there's not a ton of correlation there. The biggest factor with Eastern Shore from a performance standpoint is their one-year number trails the benchmark considerably. They're up 66%, which anytime I come and say it, the manager's up almost 70%, seemed to be a pretty good thing, but the Russell 2000 benchmark's up, was up 95% over the one-year period. So it really it was a combination of the post-COVID momentum rally and their quality manager, the growth tilt, and then into 2021, the style shift from growth being in favor to value hit them on both fronts. So they.
How much is it? I mean, the 3 and the 5 year numbers, are they endpoint determinant because of the 1 year number? I mean, how did they perform in those other 2 and 4 year periods?
We have calendar year returns in here at some point. To kind of take away the endpoint bias, I went back and looked at this chart at a few different time periods, and if you can't just say we're going to forget about the one-year number, but if we go back to, you know, end of 19 and look at this chart, they're top quartile or near it over every time period. So we expect them to perform going forward. The other way to think about the underperformance is, you know, the market was up almost 100%. They were up 70%. So if you factor that down to a more reasonable market, you know, the absolute underperformance number is huge. But you know, if the market was up 10 and they were down up 7,
and couldn't you argue that with the other firm that at 3-point-something billion they look more like an index of that? I mean, it's small cap.
Yeah,
I mean, you see what I'm saying? So they're gonna. What is their correlation to their index? To the index?
Makita, I don't know if you guys have any perspective on that. I think both of them, you know, there's 2,000 stocks in the Russell 2000, and they're holding, you know, 100. So They're not.
Oh, okay.
The closest thing that we looked at, that was like Panagora had a product that was a quantitative product that had like 200-plus holdings that had really low tracking error. That was kind of a close to a closet indexer, as we saw. Leo, Aaron, did you have something to say there?
Well, yeah. Before you, Leo, hang on. Hold on. Leo, hold on 1 second. Hey, Tina, when you look at these managers, both of them are pretty high conviction managers, because when you look at small cap, to have only 80 to 100 names is pretty high conviction, and they're both in that camp.
Yeah, this is Aaron. I agree with Gilbert. And Tina, it's a good point, though, to be thinking about that. The biggest difference is that Eastern Shore will take bigger sector bets than GW&K. So from that perspective, you could argue that GW&K will be similar to an index in terms of riding the big waves. But Gilbert's right. I mean, they're both 90% active share, very different than indexes.
I don't necessarily disagree that it looks more like the index when you think the index performed 95% and most of the managers can't outperform their bogey. So I'm not necessarily saying that's a bad thing. I just want to be aware. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Bill, here's I'm on 59. Here's the page showing the calendar year performance. To me, the biggest factor on the one-year number for Eastern Shores is not expecting that to repeat going forward, but what impact that might have on them growing their business. They've been growing pretty quick, and that one-year number is going to be a drag when people are doing searches on their 3 and 5 for a while. So I think once we hire them, if we get approval, we're going to monitor what their firm assets are doing pretty closely. They've been, they're talking about adding some people to the investment and support team. So are they able to maintain? We don't want them to get as big as GWK and grow too fast, but like I said, keeping up that clip and showing the healthy support.
How much money is going there?
$80 million would be the ultimate allocation.
Stepping in, though.
Yeah, I think we're going to likely fund $40 million initially, and then as we get money coming back from a few of these sales, like we talked about, $10 million will go here, and $10 million will go to EM debt and equity, but build it up, and then we'd like to hire the international small cap manager to pair with them towards the end of the year. So probably not be fully allocated to Eastern Shore before we make that hire.
The bottom line, I mean, look, performance, you can argue either way, but is it just they're a smaller firm with a little bit more active approach and therefore should do better going forward?
Yeah,
I mean, I think we have more conviction with them going forward. We like their alignment with ownership between the three portfolio managers, and it's a little more clear on their incentives. Both of them were Makita bullpen managers, so high conviction. It's just, are we comfortable with this style tilt and the trade-off for the smaller firm? Aaron?
And remember, if I could, this is Gilbert again. When you look at small cap, it's very different than, say, fixed income, where bigger is not necessarily better. In the bond market, it's very easy to scale. In the smaller cap stock area, in small caps, bigger becomes difficult to really get the stocks that you need. So bigger is not necessarily better. And when you look at the firm that's brought forward, I think we will be somewhere around the number 4 or 5 size client of theirs. So I think big enough to be significant to matter, but I don't think they have real concentration risk, or certainly none that we should be concerned about. I think the committee really liked that this is what they do. They're like the Kentucky Fried Chicken of small caps. They do one thing, and they try to do it well.
That's a good point, Bill.
Remember that commercial, Bill?
Kentucky
Fried Chicken, they do one thing, and they do it right, and that's chicken.
Yeah, and I mean, on size, when we actually did our original investment screen, we cut it off at $2.5 billion. So we were pretty cognizant of managers not being too big going into it. We moved that up a little bit after talking to Makita. But.
And neither of these firms are diverse firms or minority firms, are they?
Not from an ownership of being above 50% standpoint.
Okay.
But on that point, Bill, I think it'd be great or behooves us in the future to really encourage even one to be interviewed, even if we don't select them, which that's fine. At the end of the day, I think that the feedback they would receive would go a long way to helping them with their firms. I'm pleased that one or two made it all the way to the top seven or so or eight, but I think it behooves us to try to be a little more push it a little bit harder in that regard.
So Gilbert, to that point, who went back to them and talked, gave them feedback?
Say that again.
I said to that point, who went back to them and gave them feedback?
Who gave feedback? Is that what you said?
Those firms that could use it going forward. You just said that.
There were several minority-owned firms. I mean, you know, Ariel Capital's. I don't know if it's the right forum. They're a great firm. I've known them for decades. Earnest Partners is a really good firm. They've been around for decades, and there's even more, right? I don't think this is the right forum to call out managers that, you know, didn't make it. But at the end of the day, there are many out there with, you know, long histories and have done well. They just didn't make it here. And I think it behooves us to really, you know, ensure that one of them makes it to the round where we can at least interview. I think everybody benefits from such a strategy.
Yeah, I think Tina's question was, I guess that we had two diverse firms. Have you given them feedback on what they could do better?
Go ahead, there, Ryan.
I can handle if you want, just on.
Sure. Go ahead.
We interviewed Earnest Partners. Their interview wasn't great. I mean, the issue we have with Earnest is just they only have like $200 million in small cap core, and okay, they have $20 billion overall, and we were concerned of a lack of focus on this portfolio in particular.
Sure.
We haven't given them that feedback. That has nothing to do with their, you know, ownership, but they didn't really follow up after the interview either. So.
Well,
to have an avenue to give them feedback. So.
I mean, it sounds to me like staff, Makita, and the IAC have vetted this very well.
Yeah.
Does anybody have any other questions? I don't know that we need to get into
all
the detail that's here.
Not a question, but a comment, just kind of segueing what you said is, you know, I was on the IAC, and this even predates Kelly, before we even had a CIO. And this process that we do now is fantastic. I mean, everything's above board, transparent, open meetings. I mean, I would put the way we do this system against any pension system across the country. And I'm fully confident in continuing this process and hope that no matter what happens in the future, legislation or whatever, that this process that we use never goes away. It works
great.
That's
great. Thank you.
So do we have to vote?
Yeah, Gilbert, do you want to make this motion to hire Moody Aldrich for the U.S. small cap equity allocation?
Yeah, I'll make that motion. And again, that's also the staff recommendation. So that's part of the motion.
I'll
and the IAC's recommendation.
Okay, Tina has seconded. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, it carries. They are hired.
Thank you, guys. We'll keep you posted on initial funding.
Okay, Ryan, you've got private equity, private asset update?
Yes, we'll go through the cash flow report. I'm going to move ahead to all the way to 107. I guess we had a lot of small cap materials in there.
Yeah, I don't think we need all that many.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, we've tried to give the full package from the ISC, but we'll try to keep it to more summary info next time and support materials if you want to go look at them. So we covered quarterly cash flows a little bit at the outset. Just the methodology primer is we have much more control and visibility into real estate and directly owned natural resources than anywhere else, and we know what's coming back there, and we have conversations with the managers on private equity. A lot of times we're just like on HUP. We know it's going to sell at some point, hopefully, so we pick a year in the model and say it's coming back this year. So that's how we get to the projections. As I mentioned, another positive quarter with $30 million coming back. I should have rounded this number up or down, but we have $666 million right now in NAV. Private markets down from over $800 million a year ago. I'm going to move ahead to 111, just looking at the quarterly activity. I'll talk about the big transactions here. A few capital calls going out, and we'll talk more about that Lone Star one later today. Money coming back, we had about $10 million coming back from RCH, which was excess cash in the portfolio they distributed to pay down the notes to us and the Red Partners. We got an unexpected distribution from the CRA fund right at the end of the month. So our share of that was $5.8 million. Clarion sold some land right near the convention center, some parking lot land. Our share of those proceeds were $4.5 million. And this is one of those unexpected distributions where at the beginning of the year we hadn't modeled any proceeds coming out of the Clarion portfolio, and due to the kind of market activity, they had this opportunity to sell some land quite a bit above appraised value. So we were pleased to see that coming back in the CCH portfolio. See the sales proceeds from the final U.S. timber land there at FIA, and then moving down to Museum Tower, we distributed cash from the sale of the final unit.
So we are totally out now, except for some reserves? Or?
We have some storage units that we need to, that we're going to basically auction off to the homeowners. And since you asked, since you brought it up, I'll take this opportunity to ask a question. If any of you have any connections in resale furniture market or anything like that, we have furniture from the last model that we have now have to store here that we're trying to get rid of. So let me know if you have any connections.
It's very heavy and it's across the hall. I can attest to that.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I know.
And we have some art as well.
Yeah.
That we're okay. We've sent it to a pictures to a consignment place.
We can do a tour.
Send pictures as well.
Okay. So we have a little bit of cash left at Museum Tower. We'll wind that down, but the final unit sold, and we get the proceeds from that back. Moving ahead to 112, and again, this chart shows quarterly distributions and capital calls. Distributions are the orange bars on the top of the chart, and the capital calls are the orange on the bottom, blue on the top is distributions. You can see the last two quarters, the uptick in the slope of that chart and the activity. The $30 million we got back in Q2 is right about the quarterly average for 2018 and 2019. We got $76 million back this year, and that's, you know, 2020, we had very little activity, as you guys know. Had a total of $33 million in all of 2020, and we're at $76 million year-to-date. So quite a bit, big uptick. So over the last 6 months, we've sold off 10% of the private asset portfolio, and then 18% of the real estate portfolio has come back in that time period. Again, we talked a little bit earlier about the private asset adjustment, and hopefully we'll stop needing to show this next quarter, knowing there's still some downside risk in the valuations on a few of the legacy private equity, but all of the adjustment right now is in the private equity portfolio. Everything else has been trued up and reported year-end 2020. Looking at 115, it shows the go-forward projections through the end of 2023. We have $99 million planned or expected for the rest of this year. That's higher than we received in the first half. I got pretty high confidence in at least half of that. We got $25 million coming back next month. Planned sale at the red property. Those two sales alone would get us to $50 million. So half of it's in process and really high conviction, and about 80% of that coming back from the real estate portfolio this year. As always with these real estate sales, timing is the issue, and stuff could flip past end of the year if the sale gets delayed, but a good chunk of it coming from two sales. Legacy, we talked about, is at 20% right now, and expected to be a large part of the portfolio on the private side until we get through the rest of the red portfolio and the legacy private equity. When we talk about allocation and you know, with the asset allocation you guys just approved, the private asset allocation remains at 15%. We expect to get around that level towards the end of next year.
Hey, Brian, of the back on the slide with the legacy 369,
mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how much of that is Lone Star and Hop?
Yes. I adjusted the table here.
have it if you want.
It is 136.
Of the 369.
Of the 369.
And is that 136 the post adjustment?
That's post adjustment on Lone Star.
That's just Lone Star's 136.
No, Hawk's 82, and then Lone Star's the remainder. Huff
Energy's
82.
We've been writing them down.
So it's 90.
Yeah, Huff Energy's 82, Huff Alternative 9. And then Lone Star would be about 45 post adjustment.
And we just wrote it down $43 million.
Yeah. In which period?
Just, it'll be done in July.
Yeah. What's the breakout of 43 breakdown between the two?
Do we want to go into closed session, Josh? We're going to talk about private equity values, or
should we do that?
Wait until we get to the Lone Star item?
Let's talk about Lone Star and the Lone Star item.
Okay. All right. Any other questions on legacy or the projections going forward? Okay. Thank you.
Great. Okay, Kelly, you've got two or three updates for us? Yeah.
I do. Brenda has had a conflict scheduled a long time ago, and since we moved the board meeting, she's not here, but she gave me her audit update. And basically, we're on track. We provided 85% of the PPCs, the prepared by client requests, information to the auditors. We're waiting on Lone Star and Huff as usual. And once we receive that, we can provide information to the actuary, and it'll be about 60 days out. So nothing has come to our attention about adjustments or anything like that. So things are proceeding as usual, slowly. That is that. On the monthly contribution report, that's on page 120. And this is the July report that has May data. In this report, there were 175 fewer employees on the payroll than is been in the hiring plan. Fire was over the estimate by 31, and police was under the estimate by 206. We have seen a big increase in police requesting their numbers to retire. We don't know what's going on there, but the calls come in kind of waves, and right now they're high. They are doing classes. We had one of our staff members attend a in-person rookie class. Actually, it's next week. Armando's going to that as well?
For fire, correct.
Yes, for fire. Oh, yeah.
For five people.
Okay, and we've had actually one with police where we attended in person with that as well.
Oh, okay.
In May, we had two payrolls, and the actual contributions that we would have received based on comp pay was $11.4 million. That's actually about halfway between the floor and the hiring plan, so it was 97% of the floor and 105% of the hiring plan. So things are slowing down a little bit, but we still look pretty good based on where we had hoped to be. Since the inception of HB 3158, we've received almost $500 million from the city in contributions. Good.
Any idea when the police classes are going to be increased from about 20 to maximum level, which generally runs around 50 or 60?
Yeah, I don't know what their plan is. Any other questions?
No.
Okay.
No.
On the board approval for travel and education, that's page 126 of the agenda. Nobody has requested to attend anything. There are three classes listed. Two are NCPRS classes. One is an accreditation program that you can go through. I did that. I wouldn't recommend it, but that's just me. And the Tech First Summer Conference is coming up in August, and that's in San Antonio. So unless anybody wants to add their name to any of these programs or add some other class, we don't need a motion on this item.
And also on the accreditation thing, once you get accredited, you still have to go only to their training to keep your accreditation, and then, of course, NCPRS is higher in tight as far as expenses go.
Yeah. Yeah, what I didn't like about it, I thought the information actually was good, but it was a two-day marketing effort or four-day marketing effort by the people that put it on. And you have to pay to attend, so I didn't like that. But the information is good.
Good. Okay, thank you. Next item we've got is item 11, is the board elections. We're required to do this every other year. I think we did a temporary hold last month as people were gone. I've mentioned in the past that I've got a commitment to my family to spend a little bit less time on a variety of different activities, so I'd like to step down as the chairman at this point in time. I think it makes sense that I've only got one more year left on the board before my term expires, and this is an every two-year election, so I think it's a good time to transition to have somebody be the chair that will be there for the next 2 years. I've talked, and Nick has volunteered, he reluctantly volunteered, but he has agreed to do that, and he asked me if I would just swap with him and be the vice chair. So I would recommend that we elect Nick as the chair going forward. I would be the vice chair, and Armando has agreed to continue to be the deputy vice chair as well. So, we got to move.
Second.
Any discussion? If not, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Yeah, you're elected.
I'm going to do that quick.
Okay. Very good. Now we're off to, I'll finish this meeting now. Executive Director's Report.
Yes, starting on page 130 of the agenda material is the NCFERS monitor report. We actually, on the open records, we've received 7 since the last board meeting. 4 of those are from members responding to those. Office update, the office is open for business. We are taking walk-ins, we're taking appointments, employees are here. It's nice, so that's good. As far as board meetings go, the governor changed or rescinded his order on open meetings, so beginning in September, ready or not, here they come, that we'll be open and have to follow the same rules that we've been doing. So we'll be open to the public, those types of things. So in August, I'm assuming you may want this continued format where we do virtual and in person, and then the trustees can decide to attend or not, however that fits into their schedule. And then the CIO recruitment, we've received a lot of interest in that. I'm still going through the applications. I'm hoping to have kind of a first round of calls with people in the next, well, it's supposed to be next week, but now I have a conflict next week. So far, 72 applicants. Unfortunately, the obvious females in the pile are 3 of the 72, which is a little bit disappointing, but there's a lot of good candidates in the pool, so we're working through that. And hopefully in August, or probably actually, what is this month, July? Probably September, maybe have somebody for you to interview, and I'll be working with Nick and Bill on that.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Just real quick, I have a question. It's not in here, but can you go over, for the people that are listening, the classes that we have coming up and the other outreach programs that you're developing?
Yes, thank you, Armando. I actually meant to talk about that. We had an online class. So what we've done is we have our prep class, which prep is an 8-hour long class, and it's intended for people as they prepare for retirement. And we know, obviously, it's really difficult to do an 8-hour virtual class. So what we had done is we separated those classes into bite-sized chunks. So somebody could say, hey, if I only want to know about Roth, I'm going to attend this class. If I only want to know how my pension benefits calculated, I can attend this class, and survivor benefits, this class. So we've begun offering those virtual classes. They're on Zoom, and we're recording them, so we'll post those videos online.
Oh, great.
Is the plan. We are also still scheduling the prep class. I'm not sure when that first one will be. We're we haven't figured out exactly capacity in the room once we start doing in-person ones. The other thing is Mr. Smith on the phone mentioned the in-person meeting that he has requested, and he has requested it. I told him we would do it after we had testimony in this lawsuit that we're going to talk about. That testimony began last week. The department specifically does not want us to go out to the station, so we are going to have that meeting here in the training room, and Carol is looking at dates for that. At either, we're looking at last week of July, first week of August, and we're preparing to do that. So I know he feels like we're putting him off, but we're really not. We're working on a lot of different things, and one of the reasons Ryan knows that furniture is heavy that I mentioned is because when that last unit at Museum Tower sold, they brought all that over and put it in the training room, and we had staff had to move it out of the training room in preparation of that meeting. So we are moving along, but we have virtual classes that are new classes in bite-sized pieces. Those are scheduled. One has already happened, a couple more are scheduled. Not supposed to schedule, it's online somewhere. I'm not entirely sure.
I know one was yesterday. How was it attended?
I'm not sure. I haven't talked to staff to find out how they attend one. John, do you know you were on that?
I didn't do 7, 10, something like that. I think Cynthia's on the
That's okay. I mean, I don't want to bog us down.
Yeah.
So is the prep classes designed like they used to be?
They are designed like they used to be. You know, the most, and we always do surveys after this, and I read the surveys. And one of the things, the section of the prep classes that was most valuable to the members was really, oddly enough, the information about Social Security. Because how the Social Security works with their benefits and windfall elimination provisions and all of that stuff. And for that class, we pay an outside Social Security expert to come in to do that. So that's a little more challenging to do virtually and kind of all the time because it's $150 every time we bring them in. So
can't you tape it so that you
could
make it available so you don't have to pay them all the time?
I don't know if you would let us record him and not pay him each time. Maybe we did record him and just pay it every time we ran it or something like that. That would be better.
He doesn't have to show up.
Because that's the, so we bring him in. We bring in people from the city to talk about retiree health benefits and the schedule on how you retire. So it's a coordinated effort for the big prep class.
And it's no fidelity and no financial planner like we had before.
No.
Good. Nothing against, well, yeah, against one of them. In case, for those that weren't here at the time and when we had to run on the bank, the two biggest beneficiaries of that were the financial planner that we had in Fidelity. So that didn't do well with me.
Natural conflict.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You want to remember from Cynthia?
Yeah, yes. Go ahead.
Cynthia?
Yes. The class that's scheduled for next week is the drop in retirement and active, and then a class is scheduled for the retirement process the week after that. We are working now with Tom for Social Security to get on his schedule to see if we can actually get him in and get set up for him to come into the office and sit maybe in one of the counseling rooms and do his part of the session for prep. So we are preparing to go back to the old prep sometime in the third quarter. We're just now coordinating the efforts with Tom. We have not started coordinating that with the city. We're going to concentrate on first doing the prep for the DPFP process first and then get Tom involved. And then as we begin to migrate more towards coming back to having in-person classes, we'll work with the city because it's working with various people with the city. So that'll be a little bit more challenging to do online.
Was there a class last week? Somebody asked a question about how many people attended last week. Do you have that
information? There's a class. Actually, this was this past Wednesday. It was 24 participants participating in that class. We think it went very, very well. There was enough time allotted for the class for the presenter to not rush through the information and for all of the participants to be able to ask all the questions that they had. So we actually got one of the participants actually sent us an email and thanking us for doing the class for them.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess
you're welcome.
We will now move to our closed session under Section 551.071 of the Texas Government Code to receive advice from attorneys on pending legislation and litigation.